Welcome back to Who's There. I'm your host, Allison. If you're new here, thank you for joining us. This is a podcast where I talk to a new horror fan every week because I hope to destigmatize what it means to be a horror movie fan. Because most of us are just regular people who like the adrenaline rush of being scared for some reason, and here we delve into those reasons. Thanks for sticking with me as we took the week off last week due to Thanksgiving. I hope you all had a great holiday if you're in America, whether you were with family or relaxing by yourself. But this week, I'm back, and I'm so thrilled to be back because we have a horror fan and horror writer, Alex Grass, on the show. He is the author of three books that have broken into the Kindle Top 100, including Dreck, his most recent, which is a supernatural thriller that offers a peculiar but engrossing vision of the future. In this episode, we talk about why horror fans are so awesome and so much more passionate than fans of other genres, and why Alex loves Korean horror specifically. We also talk about movies like The Thing, including the 2011 prequel, which he defends, Mike Flanagan's Midnight Mass, and Dr. Sleep. One last thing before we get into this episode, if you love the show and haven't left us a review on iTunes yet, I'd be so grateful if you could take a second to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to us. Thank you to everyone who's already left us a review. It's so appreciated, and it really helps people find us. I think I've rambled enough, so let's get into this episode with Alex Grass. Hey, Alex, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. Do you want to start by telling everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure. It's always hard to pick out the highlights, but I guess the stuff that's most relevant is I'm from Pennsylvania. I say that because I got kind of like, I don't know, a more central Pennsylvanian M. Night Shyamalan thing going on where I set the stories in PA a bunch. I come from, I guess, a pretty big family. We all just met for my grandmother's 90th birthday here in Manhattan. And I got so many cousins. I got three younger brothers. We grew up sort of like scrapping with each other and making too much trouble for my mom. And let me see. What else is real important? Oh, I always like to get this out of the way. My wife is in med school. I'm very proud of her. I tell everyone that. And I hope that this is not offensive, but I also like to put in that my wife has just like fabulous breasts. And I try to put that in wherever I can. And I know that she doesn't appreciate that, but it's out of love.
Oh, well, that's very nice that you give your wife and her breasts a shout out.
Yeah, both of them. Both of them.
So you said you're in Manhattan. I didn't know you were in New York City.
No, I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, my granny had her birthday in Manhattan. She actually lives in Harrisburg still. But she came up and, boy, when she came in, she's high styling. Like she came in, my Uncle Marty always says about her that if she didn't end up being sort of like, you know, the matriarch of Harrisburg, she would have been Bella Abzug. Like she would have been a high-end civil rights lawyer or something like that. And she came in and she was just glowing. Oh my God. Like there was an aura behind her, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. And I think my old man, has caught the longevity gene too. So I'm hoping to inherit that, but you know, who knows? He's about to get a liver transplant. And you know, the funny thing is that, you know, like the two boys who called him instantly to offer up our livers are me and the brother right under me. I'm the oldest, the brother right under me, Arthur. And I'd say that the two of us had the most hard living. And he's like, yeah, my old man said, wouldn't you figure it? The two sons who are quick to give me their livers have the two shit livers.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to offer your liver to your dad.
Well, I don't know if I meant it, but it just seemed like the thing you would say.
Yeah.
No, I meant it. I'd give him my liver.
Oh, so first things first, what's your favorite scary movie?
The Thing, 100%. Nice. Unquestionably, The Thing. And I loved that movie before I even knew John Carpenter by name. I loved it before I really even enjoyed horror because I didn't really get into horror until I guess about 4 years ago. But I saw that movie, I guess, 13, 14 years ago for the first time. And I was just blown away by it. I don't know. I always say it's like, it's 12 Angry Men with aliens set in Antarctica. You know, it's the special effects are really amazing, considering the time. And I forget the where I saw it, but there's some behind the scenes documentary about the kid who did the special effects for it. I think he might have been the same guy who did An American Werewolf in London, but like really a phenom at the time. And so I guess that when I was watching it, even though we live in the, you know, the heyday or the golden age of CGI, it was still very believable to me. It's still very frightening. You know, when you watch that at night, something about like the gristle and the gore, and something about the isolation. You know, I always thought that the best horror movies are set in the darkest and most unfamiliar places. And you can't get more dark and more unfamiliar than Antarctica. And it has all the implications of death and peril. That should be present, I think, in the bleakest horror films, and that not only are they isolated, but there's no radio contact. No one's coming for them. They're going into winter. And the very nature of the monster, it's a monster that can replicate. So they can't trust each other. And it's just the perfect storm. And just as a movie, before I even categorized it as a horror movie, I was just like blown away by it. I'm like, wow. And the other thing that's incredibly underrated, I think, is the soundtrack, which is by Ennio Morricone. And Ennio Morricone is like sort of known for, I think, like spaghetti westerns. He did like, what is it? Like The Rush of Gold, or it might just be called Gold Rush, but I think he scored Sergio Leone films, but he deliberately, Morricone deliberately mimicked what Carpenter had done in his other movies. Cause you know, Carpenter scores all his stuff. And I think it was maybe the first time that Carpenter hadn't scored one of his movies, but just from the beginning, when you hear like the boom, 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 and then you hear the strings come in, very eerie.
Yeah. What do you think of the remake that was done of it, or the prequel?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was ready to take a huge dump all over it, you know, because like, I'm not anti prequel or sequel, but I do think that a lot of the time, when you like, it's very hard to like find the things that qualify as art in popular entertainment, because oftentimes, because popular entertainment is corporatized and everything has to be filtered through censors and through bureaucracy, you know, like art by committee is very difficult. And I think that horror has an advantage in the first instance because it comes from fans. Like you see production houses like Blumhouse, or you see directors like Eli Roth, or like Sam Raimi, and they really have a passion for it, you know? Like Sam Raimi can go out and do other movies. Like he did For the Love of the Game with Kevin Costner, which I actually watched with my wife, and like she loved it, but I was very surprised by it. I didn't even know that was Raimi until later. But so, you know, horror has an advantage, but I think a lot of the time people remake movies just because it's like betting on a known horse in the race. And they said, oh, the thing worked once, we can make it work again. And there were similarities, but that's not really what they did. The dynamics were very different. Like I really, you know, I like how they dove into the, like the origins of like the Norwegian team.
I haven't seen the prequel, so I'm just smiling and nodding.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I don't want to spoil it. I highly recommend it. I think it's very good.
Okay. You're the second person to tell me recently that it is good, because I had only heard previously that it was hot garbage. So
yeah,
I will watch it. I've actually only seen the original The Thing once, so I might rewatch that again too.
Yeah. It's the kind of movie it gets better, like watching and rewatching. And yeah. I probably say that because for a long time I put it on while I fell asleep, which is like, people are like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Don't you have terrible dreams? Like, yeah, but they're dreams that are very much like John Carpenter's The Thing. So it's cool.
Yeah. So you touched upon this a little bit before. You said you just got into horror about 4 years ago. How did you get into horror? How did you fall in love with it?
I tell this story a lot, and on the off chance that like anyone has ever heard me before, which is probably pretty low chances, I apologize if I run over the same ground, but about 4 years ago, I went to a rehab in Florida, and the easiest way to explain is that I just had a complete perceptual shift in just about the way I viewed everything. And I came back from Florida finding that I looked at just about every experience I had before, but also at familiar things like art in a totally new way. I had to rewatch movies and reread books that I had thought that I had hated. And with movies in particular, I found I was completely wrong. But also there was sort of like a renewed, or not even renewed, but a brand new sensitivity to things like the environment I was in, and nature, for instance. And I don't mean that in like the political sense, environmental, but the best example would be my wife and I went to this place called Mohonk Mountain, and it's run by an old Quaker family. And it's a luxury place, but it's very old school, you know, a big overlook vibe to it, you know, big overlook vibe. And there's no televisions in the rooms, and you know, like all the fun stuff is out on the lake. And they bring in lecturers each night, and I remember having had like that new interest in horror. And for me, the introduction was with Thomas Ligotti and Stephen King, you know. And Thomas Ligotti is a tremendous writer, but Stephen King is like the guy who's mostly responsible for inventing the supernatural world that, you know, us fans live in now. And I remember looking out at the lake, and it was very late at night, and trying to explain to my wife how being terrified of something, being fearful of the unknown, like looking out onto that lake and seeing nothing but, you know, like a glimmering echoes of the shadowy liquid black, and having an animal fear of that, that is a connection to something beyond ourselves. And I don't try and like foist a spiritual sensibility on that, but it is, I think, the appeal of horror. It's that there's an exploration, and in terms of the art, it's a positive exploration, because here we are, you know, like for instance, right now, sitting and talking about horror films, and you know, that's a genre that we love, right? I mean, we're not sitting here saying like, oh man, John Carpenter, what a piece of shit, and The Thing, you know, like yeah. What a fucking dumpster fire. We're talking about how we love it. And I think that the idea of the unknown and exploring it and facing the terror is like what we do in our lives. And it might seem, you know, to be mundane, but a lot of what everybody does is they face down awfulness, you know, hideous occurrences, terrible traumas, and they get on with living. You know, you don't like horror just because of the monsters. You know, you find that you like the characters, you know, or sometimes if it's really well done, like I'm not, you know, above just enjoying an hour and a half mishmash of jump scares. You know, I love that shit too.
Yeah, that definitely has its place because we don't always want to be watching horror movies that take a lot of thought.
Yeah, so. For sure. I loved Midnight Mass. Did you see it?
Yes, I loved it.
Yeah, loved it, loved it, loved it. I could not watch one of those every month.
Yeah.
Or no, every month for the rest of my life. I can't have everything be poignant and ponderous all the time. I think I would go out of my mind, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that kind of answers a question that I ask everyone, which is an article came out last year saying that horror fans were handling lockdown better than non-horror fans. Why do you think that is? Is it because what you were just saying, that you think that we watched this horrible stuff all the time, so we're kind of mentally more prepared than normal average people?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. I don't know if that's the main reason, but it's definitely got to be a big part of it. I think that, horror fans are fun, strange people. They delight in things that appall others. The horror fans are the inappropriate laughers of the world, you know? You're at a funeral and you see that, grandma's wearing two different colored socks and something tickles you, or someone farts while they're crying at the same funeral, and you just can't stop laughing. Those are horror fans. They're strange people. It's the peculiarities of the world that stand out to them. And I think probably, also it's horror fans are very passionate. I think they are in their way, some of the most fervent, most heartfelt devotees of their genre, because there's a defensiveness to it. You know, even think of the format of your show, right?
Yeah.
What are we doing here? We're defending horror against its imagined attackers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I feel the same way. You know, I do. I think that there is brilliance and there's depth in horror, and especially we were talking about Mike Flanagan. The people who don't enjoy horror, why don't you point at some piece of art that's come out recently that had as much profundity and as much meaning as Midnight Mass? I mean, that series just knocked me on my fucking ass.
Yeah, I watched it. I think I watched it all in a week. But yeah, it was very captivating and I never knew where it was going. So no spoilers here, but yeah.
Yeah. No, that was amazing that though you were, you pretty soon into the series found out what trope you were in.
Yeah.
You still didn't know where it was going.
Yeah. You had no idea. And I think it's true what you're saying, that we're very passionate, because you don't have people who love dramas that are very passionate, or comedies or romantic comedies. No one's I love romantic comedies so much, let's dissect it, because romantic comedies are kind of trash. But I love some of them. Some of them I find very entertaining, but there's not really a deeper meaning that's presented in an effective way. So
right. I mean, there's definitely people out there who will dispute that, but I'm on our side. I respect that Nora Ephron's out there working, doing her thing. I think that's cool. Yeah. I just don't want to have to go sit in the theater and watch the Nora Ephron movie,
Yeah. So we are a weird group, but there are some people who seem perfectly sane that love the horror genre. So why do you think that is? Why do you think that people who seem perfectly sane also love the horror genre?
God, that's an incredibly difficult question. And I think maybe I have too narrow a focus, because when someone asks me that, I instantly think of guys Howard Stern, Dee Snider, and Alice Cooper, because they're these guys who are known for being provocateurs, but then in their normal life, they're so vanilla.
They are. I grew up in the same town as Dee Snider, and he comes to all the soccer games and his kids' shows. I did theater with him. So
Doesn't he goes to every event for his kids? He goes to church every week.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
By the way, I have a feeling that horror fans would like this. If you can go onto YouTube and find him testifying for the parental advisory hearings. I think it's the House hearings, not the Senate hearings, but he is so well-spoken and so passionate and eloquent in defense of free speech. I think it's something that's like, especially for us horror fans, it's something worth listening to right now. Because, you know, I think there's always going to be a Puritan streak in American culture.
Yeah. And unfortunately.
I think maybe we're not aware of it because, you know,
it's all like we know.
It's all we know. The country's so big.
Yeah.
You know, like we're a country that in any other place would be like, you know, like pieces of two continents, like,
yeah,
like from Kazakhstan to Macedonia or something, you know?
Totally. What's your favorite subgenre in horror?
I guess like this, like the psychokinesis stuff. Like I really enjoy the universe that Stephen King made, from like The Dead Zone to Dr. Sleep, you know, back to The Shining. Like the idea that there's just heightened perception and layers of existence beyond our own, you know, reaching, you know, in terms of either it could be prophecy, you know, forward looking into the future, or it could be, you know, retrospective in communicating with the dead, or I guess it's actually not retrospective at all, you know, because the idea is that, you know, the dead are somewhere or they occupy some netherworld, you know, and in between our place here on earth and the ultimate beyond, whatever that is. And I enjoy it because I think it really focuses on like the horror of human beings. Cause it's basically amplifying, you know, the regular, or not the regular, but the more common malice of what human beings do, you know, cause the bad guys are like, for instance, in Dr. Sleep, you know, the true knot, they're just people, right?
Yeah.
Who figure out a way to vampirically suck out the life force of other people. And I think that those explorations are, you know, pretty great. But I also really enjoy like anything that has a very visually distinct occult element to it, you know? So like someone would say Hellraiser is body horror, right?
Yeah.
Right. But I see the whole film is framed inside, you know, that little fucking box, right? That little, that little toy box. And I know there's a term for it, but I forget. So let's just call it like some fucking, you know, Renaissance era cube automaton. And the idea that it can unleash this great evil. That wasn't my generation, but my understanding is that, you know, when Clive Barker did that shit, it was completely revolutionary, you know? I mean, especially like the idea of like, you know, we were talking about Puritanism in America, you catch like bloodthirstiness and mutilation with sexual gratification. Oh my God. I wish I was around to like see, you know, like Tipper Gore's head explode, you know, or whoever, it doesn't matter who, you know, just like the, like whatever the equivalent of for like Media Matters or, you know, Focus on the Family or whichever one is focusing on trying to control what people say.
That's a whole nother topic entirely.
No, I don't want to get into it. I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah. Totally. So we've already touched upon that you love John Carpenter. Is he your favorite horror director?
I'd say Flanagan probably is.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. John Carpenter, I mean, John Carpenter, it's kind of like, you know, like imagine you go into like the great high council of horror, right? And you see the great wise sage sitting, you know, atop the main throne. That would be John Carpenter. But like the guy that I would go over and nudge that would probably be Flanagan, you know, like, yo, Mike, what do you think of this? You know, you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely. He seems a little bit more touchable, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know why I even say that, because I've actually watched interviews with Carpenter and the guy seems cool as shit, you know.
Yeah. Why do you love Flanagan so much?
He's different. He's different, and he's loyal to the genre while looking to raise the bar, you know? He's not phoning it in. And the impression that I get is that he has to be a workaholic, because you notice the details in everything he does.
Yeah.
You know, like the acting is so strong. The stories are incredible. The originality is there. The cinematography is great. You know, like the two, like I love the vista shots he does. Like you get, you know, you don't see that too much in horror. Just like, we pan out and we see exactly where we are. You get a sense of, like, anyone who watched Midnight Mass really got a strong sense that they were on, you know, like a fisherman's island, like, you know, like a mini Nantucket kind of thing, you know. Nantucket in the 18th century when it was whalers, you know.
Yeah, he said that they started filming before COVID hit, and then they had to shut down once the pandemic started. So when they got to go back, everything was kind of like grown over. So it kind of looked a little bit like eerie. So I thought that was really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Incidental benefits.
Yeah. What's your favorite Flanagan film?
I mean, probably Dr. Sleep, because I'm so like already predisposed to, it's my favorite Stephen King book. Mm-hmm. And it was that, you know, like the instant that I read it. And then like, when I found out they were making a movie, I like blew, speaking of head exploding, I fucking went nuts, yeah. You know? And it was the kind of thing where it was like a known obsession too. So I ran into the kitchen and I'm like, Gina, my wife, Gina. My wife, who's in medical school, Gina, I'm like, they're making a movie of Dr. Sleep. She's like, I'm so happy for you.
Oh, well, that's nice. Is she a horror fan?
Yeah. You know what? She introduced me to Korean horror.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Cool. Which I love. God, they're so fucked up, man.
Yeah.
They're like, they just like, I love it that they go, they go beyond, they go so far beyond the line. They go like the transgressions of transgressions of transgressions.
If like, you like that kind of stuff, you have to check out the movie The Sadness, which is a Taiwanese movie. Put it on your list for when it comes on streaming. It goes even further than Korean movies.
Yeah, I think that actually, speaking of like exciting new stuff, I think that a lot of the stuff that's coming out of Asia is incredible. I think that like the exposure that like Bong Joon-ho got for Parasite, like if people go back and like, cause I was a huge fan of The Host. I just thought that movie was, I thought it was so cool, you know? And it has all his dark fucked up humor in it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But, I didn't know that was him. I know. Didn't he do, what's the movie that I'm thinking of? I don't know.
Snowpiercer?
Snowpiercer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that movie.
Yeah. That's dark. That's real dark.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's your favorite Stephen King book besides Dr. Sleep?
Besides Dr. Sleep? Oh. Yeah. All right. I'm going to make this difficult. Desperation, probably.
That sounds happy.
It's like... I don't know if it's because it is a very good book, but I read it before I was interested in horror. It's like about 15 years ago. I was living in the desert in the south of Israel, and the book is about, or it takes place in the desert in the southwest, but still.
Yeah.
And it freaked the shit out of me, you know? And at bottom, I think that's what great horror does. It frightens you and it takes you back to that place that you were at in your childhood, where there are many more unknowns than there are in adult life.
Yeah.
And so the potential to be destroyed by the unknown things is terrifying to you as a kid. Yeah, that was really good. Oh, you know what? Rose Matter is awesome. The book Rose Matter. Yeah, it's Stephen King, I think, like, yeah, a lot of people disagree with it. I think he does like a really great job with female antagonists. I thought, like, it's this woman, she flees a terribly abusive relationship. Like, even the relationship's abusive enough that it even rates within Stephen King's scale of abuse in his books, which is rough, right?
Yeah.
And then the husband chases her down, and the husband is like a closeted homosexual crooked cop, you know? But you have the tension there because, as the reader, like, you see, like, everyone is in love with him, or not in love with him, but everyone has reverence and respect for him because he's a cop and he has like a really good close rate, you know? So it shows you, I think, the ways where, like, you know, the loner or the person apart can get screwed, you know? And I think thematically it's something you see in horror a lot, right? It's like, you know, it's like the scapegoat syndrome, or like the outsider syndrome. Like, look at that fucking weirdo, you know? Yeah. Let's string him up.
So you've published 3 books. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Sure. The last one that was published is called Dreck. Dreck is, speaking of scapegoating, it's about a monster who appears at the end of, basically it's World War III. And so this monster appears sort of as like an omen. So the war is closing, it's an armistice, and then a portal opens up in the middle of what used to be Syria. And it's a light with fire, and it's, you know, luminescent, glowing at the edges. So, you know, like, it has that sort of magpie drawing effect, and soldiers come close to it. And then the first 7 soldiers that touch it instantly die. And right after that, Drek steps out of the portal. And so he becomes sort of the universal object of loathing for the entire post-bellum, the post-war world. And then one day he appears in a mortuary in Pittsburgh, his dead body, right? Yeah. And so, you know, without giving away, you're left to wonder, like, why on earth would this monstrous creature, who is, you know, huge in physical presence and, you know, grotesque in appearance, you know, all the creepy crawly stuff, just a deformed face and bizarrely neon lit eyes and antlers coming out of his head, and like a broad shouldered, but not in like an appealing way, broad shouldered in like Andre the Giant wearing the Holocaust cloak in the Princess Bride sort of way, you know? And so he was untrackable too, the character Drek. So he just appears in this mortuary. He's never really been pinned down. He's more like he's like halfway between a real villain and, you know, Bigfoot, because like he's real enough that people can track his movements, but he's never been pinned down. And then he appears in this mortuary, and it just makes the entire town of Seven Points, which used to be Pittsburgh, go absolutely out of their minds. And religious kooks come out of the woodwork. The self-appointed mayor named Huey Pregado wants to get a hold of his body. And it's because they theorize that the body, because it's connected to that supernatural currents out in the desert, has some sort of latent magical ability that they can use to, you know, forward their own evil ends.
Oh, wow. That sounds really interesting. What inspired you to come up with that story?
I outlined that whole story while I was sitting in an orientation, and a guy was lecturing on hospice care. It's weird. Like, I had the idea for the monster Drek for a while, and I sort of sketched it out. And then I outlined the whole thing just sitting there. And I don't usually write like this, you know, but I outlined like the whole thing bit by bit. And then I wrote it in, I'm going to say 3 or 4 weeks. Wow. Yeah. And it's like, it's my favorite. It's the favorite thing that I've ever done. Not, you know, like creatively. Like
we won't tell your children.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I haven't done my kids. That's sick. Jesus.
Sorry. Bad phrasing. is Drek out yet? Can people find it?
Yeah, on Amazon.
All right, cool.
On Amazon. All praise Bezos.
Oh, no.
Lord Bezos, who rules all and sees all.
Are your other two books also in the horror genre?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Black River Lantern is the first book that was published. I'd say it's like a lot more like classic eldritch horror. You know, it's set in a rural environment, and it does have to do with the, you know, like that favorite of my subgenres, like the psychokinetic prophetic ability. The main character Eddie is just sort of, he's put upon in the harshest way possible by his father, who runs the carnival that he works at, that they both work at. So it's called the Maravicos Summer-Long Carnivale. And Papa Maravicos is just like a brutal, brutal, violent drunk. And he's been doing terrible things to Eddie his whole life. And as the trauma piles on, Eddie's abilities become more and more powerful. And so, you know, consequently, Papa Maravico sees more opportunities to leverage Eddie's abilities. And in the end, it ends up completely exploding, you know, as a perpetual cycle of abuse eventually must, you know, yes. Yeah. either in rebellion or in the terrible and sometimes inevitable fate of the subject of abuse.
Yeah. Well, awesome. I will leave links to all those in the show notes so people can read them.
Far out.
Yeah. So like we were talking before we hit the record button, you have three kids. Are you planning on introducing them to horror?
That's a good question. The oldest one, I don't have to do much. She read The Shining when she was like 11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's there.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah, she's there. And like when I ask if she's seen something, she's usually already seen it, you know?
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Although she's much more into that. This is strange to me, but when I was younger, like, my brother was into like Japanese manga and anime. And I guess 20 years ago or more, that seemed a lot more fringe, but now it seems to be having its moment. Mm-hmm. And so she's also I guess Japanophile. So her and her mom are going to Tokyo in April or May, which I promised to her when she was like 12. And, you know, now I'm like, oh man, we actually have to pay for that, but it's okay.
That's awesome. What about the other two?
The other two, they're much younger. So Lucia's, oh my God, she's 16. Jesus. When does the shit happen? Okay. The other ones are much younger. Joey's 6 and yeah, I don't know yet. I don't know yet if he'll be into it. You know, he's a little different. He's not talking yet. So like we're doing like basic stuff before we get to, you know, yeah, like our genre preferences.
Yeah.
You know? So, but he seems to like the Marvel movies. Okay. So, yeah, like I like if we can get him within the broader category of just like weird or speculative fiction, I feel like as he gets older, I could pull him in. And then, my youngest Louis, he's almost 3. But he's just a little devil. So I assume that I'm going to have no problem. Do I want to introduce them to it? 100%.
Yeah.
100%. It's a lot of fun. You know, that's the big thing. It's like horror is a lot of fun. The people who watch it really enjoy it. It's not like this bizarre, you know, occult fucking collection of, you know, like Columbiners. It's just people who are passionate about a very, very strange set of subjects.
Yeah, definitely. My friend Jody, who's been on this podcast, has 6 kids and he is slowly introducing them to horror. Some of them he knows are not into it. So he's like, I'm not forcing it on any of them. If they want to come to the dark side, I'll introduce them slowly. But yeah. Are there any horror movies that you won't watch or that you won't watch ever again?
Yeah, The Changeling freaks the shit out of me.
Oh, really? I watched that once last year and I didn't find it scary at all.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's like what the time of night that I watched it. It's just, I think the sound editing on that, it was so good. It just creeped the shit, like the with something about the tenor of the voice, you know? Yeah. And also my middle kid, my boy, his name is Joey, and the deceased boy's name was Joey. So I think I was just like, ick, you know?
Yeah.
I probably won't watch that again. That one that left me, I don't know. Do you have a movie you watch where afterwards you feel like you still have something on you, you know, like,
Maybe like Hereditary.
Ooh, you know what? That's a good example.
Yeah. I mean, I will watch that not continuously, but like I will repeat view that. I own it. And it leaves you feeling terrible, but it's also a really good movie. So,
yeah.
As Ari Aster says, it's a family drama. So,
yeah, it is. God,
yeah,
that is a good one. That is a good one. Oh, another one that's like, I don't think it's quite the same, but has just sort of like I call it like just the flowers in the attic feeling, you know, just like that sort of like bizarre family, dirty feeling, you know, is Orphan. I really liked Orphan.
Oh, I have only seen The Orphan. I've never seen, you're talking about the Mexican film, correct?
No. That's The Orphanage.
Oh, okay.
I'm probably talking about the same one you're thinking of.
The girl who, spoiler alert, she's not young.
Yeah, she's an old Romanian lady. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great. The sequel's coming out soon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I love that fucking movie, man. I love that movie. I was and I had not heard of it before. This was like early on in my horror education. I'm watching it. And when you find it out, I'm like, what? No way.
Yeah, it's a good reveal. And they de-aged her for this because she obviously, I think it's a prequel.
Right.
So, yeah. Well, obviously.
She's got to be a foot taller. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But speaking of sound design, I've been debating getting like a pair of like sound canceling headphones that I can sync to my TV to watch certain horror movies. I've heard that the Blair Witch Project is scarier with headphones in. I've never found the Blair Witch Project scary, so I'm like, maybe this will help. And like, I'd rewatch all the Paranormal Activity movies and like maybe Hereditary and The Lodge, just like all that stuff.
So, I think that's a good call.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, when you like invest in it, you start noticing it a lot more. And sound editing is like to me, the hardest job in showbiz is Foley artists. They're the guys who do like, if you hear a bullet or if you hear a limb breaking, you hear anything in a movie, they're doing that, you know? And I also feel that way, I think, probably because of the soundtrack and The Thing. You know, just you start noticing a lot more, and they're sort of the unsung heroes of horror, you know, like there's great terrifying sounds that have become so iconic, like, you know, like the alien shriek, you know. Definitely worth it.
I remember one of my first movies back in a movie theater during the pandemic, after the pandemic, was Quiet Place 2. And it was so hard to be like, no, you have to go back to the theater. You need to like have the lack of sound surround you. You need to be in it. And it's like, this movie is pretty much silent. Well, I mean, the sequel's not, but you're like, no, you have to go to the theater to experience the silence. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, it's because there are so few places in our lives where there's utter silence,
Yeah.
Right.
And like few distractions besides some maybe bad audience members.
Right. Exactly. I'm a candy wrapper crinkler. I just want to apologize to anyone who has been at the Astoria Cineplex recently. I like Sour Patch Kids. That's my bad, guys.
Ah, nice. So on that same note, have you ever had any noteworthy experiences seeing a horror movie in theaters?
I want to say no. Maybe, you know what? There was like a guy who had stabbed somebody when Scream came out when I was a kid in Philadelphia.
Oh.
Yeah. And I remember hearing
about that.
Yeah. Well, it's possible it's made up because I think I remember hearing it from an adult. And that seems to fit into like it's a cousin to Satanic Panic, you know? Yeah. Like there's a Wes Craven movie and children are getting murdered there. But I remember going to see it after that had happened and being like extra scared.
Yeah.
And it's not a particularly scary movie, but you know, the idea that, you know, you could get stabbed is frightening, I think, to most people.
Yeah.
To almost everybody. Yeah. I'm going to say stabbing's a universally scary experience.
I think that's fair.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Fair enough. Yeah.
What's been your favorite horror movie that you've seen in 2021?
Probably Bad Hair.
I haven't even heard of that.
Yeah. It's a Hulu original. I thought it was pretty darn good. I mean, it's this, the protagonist is a woman who, she's a Black woman who works at, I guess like the early equivalent of, I don't know what the channel would be, but it was like BET or something like that. Or, you know, maybe it's like a fictionalized analog of BET. And she's just like not getting noticed. And she's sort of being taken advantage of by one of the lead video jockeys who's played by Jay Farrow, who does like an amazing job of just coming off as like a, you know, like a slime ball minor villain. And I really admire when people can do that, because I don't think that viewers really recognize like how much work people put into making you hate them.
Yeah.
It's like really great actors are the only ones who can do that, you know? What's her name? The woman who played Keen in Midnight Mass.
Oh, you know?
Oh, like I wanted to murder her, you know? It's like, oh God, you were so awful, you know? The kind of villain where you get through the whole movie and if that person doesn't die, you come off pissed, you know. Those are incredible actors. But the movie is like she's getting trod on by all these people, and then she speaks up in a meeting, and the woman who notices her, who's Vanessa Williams, says like, listen, like it's great, but like you're never really going to get ahead until you like get your hair get a weave, because at the time this is like I guess a huge moment in Black culture where, you know, women were starting to get weaves, and she gets it and like her whole life changes, you know. She becomes a huge executive, but there's a cost, right? And the hair comes alive, and like it sounds so cheesy, but it's actually so good.
But that kind of sounds like the Shudder original Slacks.
Oh, I've never seen that.
It's about a pair of evil genes, but it has a good moral meaning underneath it, but it just sounds cheesy when you're like killer jeans.
Yeah No, I mean that's the same thing like killer weave, you know. It's not it doesn't seem very imposing, but there's also sort of, there's like bad hair is rooted in at least according to the film slave folklore, you know.
Yeah.
And so that adds an interesting layer to me. I sort of enjoy that. There's something like the there's something that's hidden and mysterious when you're reaching back beyond your own century and even the century prior to like something enigmatic and scary and and something that has been scary for a long time to many generations, you know? So the idea that a body part needing to nourish itself and becoming its own possessed entity on its own, that's like very frightening, I think, especially because, you know, people feel unsafe, I think, when they're not in control. And the idea of like something in your person being outside of your control, where it's a part of you and it's directing what you do, even though you can't control it, scares the shit out of people.
Totally.
I thought it was great. I highly recommend it.
Awesome. I'll put it on my list. What horror movie are you most looking forward to seeing in 2022?
Can I count Multiverse of Madness? I know it's an MCU movie, but it's rumored to be a horror movie because Sam Raimi's coming in to direct it.
Sure. I don't mind.
Yeah. It's like, you know, maybe like a little bit of like a pop choice, but
yeah.
I mean, I love the shit out of Sam Raimi's movies. Like, I remember watching Evil Dead 2 with my friend Aram, and we were just like so drunk and so high and just like laughing the whole time, you know? Laughing with Sam Raimi, by the way.
Nice.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. So on that same note, are there any horror movies that you love that people generally don't like, or do you have any unpopular horror opinions?
Ooh, I can't really think of something that I really enjoy that people don't like. Usually I find it's the other way around. Like someone likes a horror movie and this might seem like a cop-out. I don't really believe in the divides between the subgenres. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess for a long time, like people said, this is in terms of weird fiction culture, this is ages ago, but they say you couldn't do sci-fi and horror, mm-hmm. you know? And I guess the unpopular opinion maybe is like, I just don't buy into like the bisecting and subdividing like smaller genres against each other, you know? I think that like the appeal of horror is in exploring the unknown and allowing that fear is part of the human experience. And, you know, beyond that, like saying whether or not, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon or a werewolf is more terrifying is, you know, it's just not interesting to me. Oh, by the way, strong recommend werewolf movie, Late Phases.
Okay.
Yeah. It's awesome. So it's about a blind war vet who moves to like a 55 plus senior community, mm-hmm. and discovers that like a werewolf is coming to murder the senior citizens at night.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's real good. Real good.
If you could remake one horror movie, which one would it be?
God, that's gotta be the hardest one so far. To remake a horror movie. Okay, here's an unpopular opinion. The Shining.
Totally valid. I think a lot of people would agree with you.
Yeah. Just because the book is so rich, you know, there's so much in the book. And what Kubrick made was brilliant, but it wasn't The Shining. It has become, you know, a cherished piece of art in its own right, obviously, because like Flanagan's Dr. Sleep is, you know, it's a sequel to the movie as much as it is, a filmic representation of the book Dr. Sleep, you know?
Yeah.
So it's cool, but I would be interested in seeing, you know, like a 3.5 hour long, you know, you know, just like something more The Shining, but not like the miniseries they had on CBS or, you know. Oh, you know what? The easier answer is The Stand. I think every version of The Stand has sucked. That's my opinion.
All right, cool. I would love to see a new version of The Shining because I thought it was real boring, but that's just me. That's my unpopular opinion. So my last question, as always, is if you had to spend quarantine with one horror villain, who would it be?
Pennywise. Probably Pennywise.
Yeah, kind of fun.
Yeah, I feel like I could win him over. I'd be like, listen, I know that you are going to use your alien voodoo magic to try and make me descend into madness, and then you will use your giant teeth to gnaw at my body and soul. Until then, Pennywise, why don't you let me help out a little bit? We could have a good time. You know? Or how about, no one's gotten your side of the story, Pennywise. I can be your biographer, you know?
Yes.
Maybe this whole thing's a misunderstanding, man. Maybe we get your voice out there.
That we should be your next book.
Pennywise's side of Pennywise, the true story.
Yes.
Authorized biography by Alex Grass.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yes. Amazon. You just type in Alex Grass. And I'm on Goodreads. I'm not really on anything else, but I'm really great on Goodreads. So, and I think it's a fabulous site too. That's like another great place that you see like a community at work, especially horror. And I answer all the emails that I get from there. I've met some pretty cool people, some pretty cool readers, you know.
Awesome. Are you on Twitter or Instagram or anything?
No. Good for you. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you again so much.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
That's it for this week's episode of Who's There. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alex Grass, and thanks again to Alex for coming on. I'll leave links to his Goodreads profile and where you can buy his books in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at Who's There Pod or on Instagram at Who's There Podcast. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, horror movie recommendations, or you'd like to be a guest, shoot us an email at hello@whostherepodcast.com. Until next time, stay scary and get vaccinated.